And I'll remind you that we're going to be speaking with Zafar Bengash and also with Steve Gowans, if I hadn't said that. You know, we have this agreement, which was signed by the Government of Canada in the midst of the election. It's my understanding, is a Trans-Pacific Partnership, and people are against it and people are for it, but very few people quite understand it. And Mr. Gowans has written an article, and you can find it at gowans.wordpress.com, where he treats of this issue. And really, to me, will be an eye-opener, let's put it that way. People need to know about this. To give you advance thoughts about it, he points out that, of course, it's a U.S.-led initiative, which is basically designed to build a trade group against China. He says it says Pacific, and two major Pacific powers are Russia and China. Neither are invited to be members. And so when you don't invite people, that means you don't like them all that much, or you have some reason why that is not admirable. He does say in his article that if they do put a proviso that if China will change its ways, they'd be happy to have them as members. And what they mean by China changing its ways is that it has to not have practice economic nationalism. It mustn't protect its industries and such, which many Canadians jump up and down saying, why can't we do that, or why don't we do that, or when are we going to do that? In other words, the economic structure of China has to be surrendered, which in bald terms, it's called economic warfare, which usually drags tin cans on its tail, leading to war. It's very dangerous kind of posture, but of course it's the American posture signed on to by 12 other governments, and Stephen Gowans deals with this in depth. And the issue that's going to have to be addressed by whoever gets to be prime minister, that we've had the three parties take different views. One says we've signed it and it's okay. The one says it's probably okay, but we want to see the fine print. And the other one says, well, we're going to scrap it. To the guy who says we're going to scrap it, Gowans points out that now you have 12 other countries involved. And so there's 11 countries are going to be unhappy with you if you say to them, oh, we've decided to scrap it. So it's a very interesting article, one that you really need to read, gowans.wordpress.com. Speaking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And he also indicates something very important, that the same issue of complaining about what they call the State Department and, pardon me, / Pentagon, calls economic nationalism. And two of the countries that they found guilty of economic nationalism in recent years were Libya and now Syria. And when they draw up their indictment of what it is that they don't like about Syria, as they did with what they didn't like about Gaddafi, was that they practice economic nationalism. In the old days, they would have said protectionism. But this is I give it to Stephen Gowans for having the clarity and the courage to just bell the cat and call this thing by its proper terms. This is intimidation, and it's a sort of do as we say or suffer consequences. In the case of Libya, the consequences were awful. In the case now with Syria, it's awful, and there might even be a remedy there. And we expect to speak shortly with Stephen Gowans, who's written this important article at his blog, gowans.wordpress.com, concerning this trade agreement, which is very, very much in the news here. And frankly, I've felt that it's been rather hard to understand. There's narrowly, there's some issues, obviously, that people can easily identify, but the larger ones of why this has arisen now and why the urgency and all is best handled by Mr. Gowans. So, and we are very fortunate. We have Stephen Gowans with us right now, I believe. Are you there, Stephen?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Well, Stephen, thanks very much for joining us. And that's I want to say that I think you, I was just explaining to listeners, I think your article clarifies a great deal about what this agreement that we all come to know now as the TPP agreement. And it's kind of like, I thought you might even have the basis of a West Side Story. It's like you're telling the story of a group of nations being brought together by a very large, dominating country, the United States, in order to have a problem with China. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd say to understand why the United States has brought together 11 other countries, it initiated this agreement among 11 countries within Asia and the Pacific Rim. And why it did so was essentially, well, if we read some of the press accounts recently in the United States, there's been a lot of crowing about how this is a win, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a win for the United States because it contains China, which is the word they often use, contains. Mm-hmm. Or this is talked about as being the economic arm of the much-extolled U.S. pivot to Asia. Mm-hmm. Which is aimed at bolstering the United States' presence in the Asia-Pacific region. Mm-hmm. Now, it's kind of interesting that this is portrayed as a win for the United States in its contest with China for clout in Asia. But if you look at the economic position of the United States versus China, you get at the roots of why it is that the United States has initiated this trade and investment agreement. So as recently as 2004, the United States was the largest trading partner of the countries in Southeast Asia.
2004?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And today, China is the largest trading partner in the region. It's also the largest trading partner of Japan, of Korea, of India, and of Australia. If we look at the China Development Bank and the Export-Import Bank of China, they now provide more loans to the region, to the Asia-Pacific region, than does the U.S.-dominated World Bank or the Asia Development Bank combined. Mm-hmm. And then China has also persuaded U.S. allies like Britain, Germany, South Korea to join the Asia or Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, mm-hmm. which they did over U.S. objections. And then China is also setting up other trade pacts around the Asia-Pacific region. Mm-hmm. And so, and on top of this, we have U.S. corporate leaders complaining to the State Department and to the U.S. administration that Chinese state-owned enterprises are, quote, pounding U.S. companies, not just in China, but in competition globally. Mm-hmm. And so there's this concern in Wall Street and in the corporate world.
Important street.
Yes, China is winning the economic war in Asia, if we want to call it an economic war, and that the deals that, you know, China is striking, the roads and dams and power plants it's building in the region, the trade it's carrying out, these represent lost opportunities for U.S. banks and corporations and investors. And if we even look at what the U.S. Defense Secretary has said about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He said, time is running out. We already see countries in the region trying to carve up these markets. Mm-hmm. So what was driving the Trans-Pacific Partnership from the U.S. point of view was competition, economic competition from China. Mm-hmm. And so the Trans-Pacific Partnership sets out to contain China economically in two ways. First, by having the partners of this arrangement reorient their economies from China to the United States. So, for example, during the talks, U.S. negotiators stipulated that countries joining the TPP would cut back on their imports from China. So as an example, the U.S. negotiators demanded that Vietnam, which is a major garments exporter, reduce its reliance on textiles made in China in order to get preferential access to the U.S. But this would be good for the United States because the United States and Mexico are especially large textile producers, and Vietnam would have to shift its sourcing of yarns and fabrics from China to the U.S. and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So this reveals that one of the important aims of the TPP is not free trade. I mean, it's often described as a free trade agreement, but really the aim is to disrupt China's growing trade relations with its neighbors in order to bolster U.S. trade and U.S. profits.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, the TPP isn't as much about free trade as it is about restricting trade and investment within a U.S.-dominated bloc and excluding the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And it's expected that the TPP will have injurious economic consequences for China. It's expected it'll cost China about $100 billion a year in lost exports because the partners will trade more among themselves and less with China.
Yeah. Now, this is Stephen Gowans, by the way, gowans.wordpress.com. This is a terrific article. I hope people will go to that site. You mentioned that at the core of this is a little problem that the U.S. has and doesn't seem to be talked about enough. They don't appreciate countries protecting themselves. They practice something called economic nationalism, and you draw some sinister, I shouldn't say sinister, but troubling conclusions. You pointed out that this matter got raised with two countries, Libya and Syria.
Yeah, they don't like countries doing what they did, which is essentially using the state.
A recognizable trait.
Yes, the state using its levers to develop the country economically, being the dominant country and economic country in the world, or dominant economic power. Obviously, they don't want competitors. But China and a number of countries that have kind of fallen or become targets of U.S. regime change operations have been following development models that, say, Germany and Japan and South Korea have followed to develop economically. So, for example, China's economy is still highly state-dominated. It has tens of thousands of state-owned enterprises that dominate half of China's economic output. So, for example, state-owned enterprises in China account for 96% of its telecom industry, 90% of its power industry, three-quarters of its auto industry. And there's just two Chinese state-owned enterprises alone.
Think how those things could grow under capitalist and liberated capitalist economy.
Yeah. But, I mean, to give you an idea of just how the state dominates the Chinese economy, so yes. Two Chinese state-owned enterprises, China Petroleum and Chemical and China Mobile, generate more profit than China's 500 largest private firms.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that kind of development model, a state-directed development model, where you have state-owned enterprises, you have subsidies provided by the government, you have state direction, this kind of dirigiste economy. And we've had similar models in Libya and in Syria. In Libya, there was a lot of complaint at the State Department, and this is revealed in some of the leaked diplomatic cables from WikiLeaks. There are complaints about Gaddafi's economic nationalism or his resource nationalism and complaints that he was, quote, trying to Libyanize the Libyan economy.
Yeah. Oh, there's a crime that you can imagine how that would affect the ordinary Libyan. Oh, isn't that terrible? He wants to Libyanize. It's absurd on the face of it, except at the State Department, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And then if we look at Syria, you see similar complaints heard in Washington about Syria. So if you look at the U.S. Library of Congress country study, the U.S. Library of Congress does studies of various countries, and they have one of Syria. And if you go read it, you'll see that they refer to, quote, the socialist structure of the Syrian government and economy, mm-hmm. and then point out that the government continues to control strategic industries, as the Chinese government does in China, and as the Libyan government was trying to do in Libya. Mm-hmm. And then they complain that senior regime members, which would be Assad, have hampered the liberalization of the economy, which is the big complaint in about China. They haven't liberalized the economy and opened it up.
Yeah, you mentioned it was really a salient part of the article. You mentioned that they do have like a clause saying, well, China could be part of this provided they do the following things.
Yeah, and that was another, yeah. So, I mean, one aspect of the TPP is to exclude China in order to open up markets for the U.S. or to reduce competition. But there's also an attempt to pressure China, and that's one of the ways in which you're pressuring China is by saying, okay, what we're going to do is reorient these economies away from you toward the United States, but if you want to join our club, well, then you're going to have to change. And changing means abandoning your state-directed development model and adopting a model that's more congenial to the interests of Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Which means that you have to stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises. In fact, we'd prefer if you had no state-owned enterprises at all. Mm-hmm. And that you do what the U.S. foreign policy is entirely directed towards, and that is opening up the world for U.S. trade and investment and keeping it open. Mm-hmm. Open up your doors to allow, you know, super wealthy people on Wall Street to accumulate more capital.
Well, by the way, when they first sent the American warships a century ago into Japan, it was open them up or we'll blow them open.
Yeah.
And indeed, in the case of China, they walked in and did it.
Yeah.
So that downtown Shanghai, they had a sign saying, no dogs or Chinese allowed.
Yeah. And now they can't do
it. I guess that's a dream. Huh? They want to resume that.
And they do. And
it is a dream.
That's kind of an important point because they can't do that anymore because China is too strong militarily. Mm-hmm. But they can try to use these kinds of trade and investment arrangements that exclude China and mm-hmm. contain it economically and put sufficient pressure on China that it capitulates. Which is why, and I think this is really significant, the U.S. Defense Secretary said that the TPP is as important to him as another aircraft carrier.
Ah. The title is Pacific Partnership and American Aircraft Carrier. And when I read it, I thought, well, that sounds extreme, but it turns out that's out of the mouth of Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. So, which seems to be saying that, you know, trade and investment arrangements and the Pentagon are really both instruments of the U.S. corporate and financial world, which are deployed by Washington's political elite to secure overseas investment and the export interests of U.S. corporations. So they can't use gunboats today in China to open up China to U.S. investment and exports. So they have to try some other method, which mm-hmm. is the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, they've invoked this, I guess it's a basketball metaphor of pivoting. There is a chance that they might, when you pivot, you have to take the ball with you. I wonder if, these other countries don't sound like the happiest campers, some of them. I wonder, even in our present election, you have three positions. One says, well, we signed it and it's done and that takes care of that. The other was, well, we signed it, but we're going to look at the fine print. And then someone else said, well, we're going to scrap it. But you point out it's not so easy to scrap because you have, what, is it 12 signatures or 11 countries, 11 or 12?
12.
12.
Yeah.
So when one tells 11 others, I've decided to take my ball and go home, that ain't going to work, is it?
No, I mean, this was initiated by the United States. That's an important thing. It's not as if 12 countries just got together and said, hey, why don't we come up with a trade and investment agreement? It was the United States that drove this, and other countries.
So when the phone rang, the minute whoever picked it up said, oh, here comes a headache. They're going to want a trade agreement.
Mm.
wouldn't that be roughly the scenario? In other words, Ottawa didn't call Washington and say, hey, you know, we ought to have a big, let's have a Trans-Pacific. The call came from Washington.
Yes.
And how do you tell them no? You don't hang up, obviously.
No. You don't.
Can you speak, by the way, to some of the concerns that people have here? I mean, after people are worried about transfer of jobs and that kind of thing. I think you acknowledge that was part of, you said that was the sort of the easy part to see that. But could you address that a little bit about why Canadians ought to be concerned? What they're getting into?
Well, I think the concern that Canadians would have might be the same concern that the Chinese have, although maybe not to the same extent. I mean, the concern from the Chinese point of view is that they have a development model that reflects the interests of the domestic economy and the people living in China. It says that their development comes first and comes before the interest of investors on Wall Street or investors in the United States. Mm-hmm. But the same applies to Canada or other members of the pact, and that is that the pact limits the ability of the government to intervene in the economy and act in ways to serve public policy goals.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to protect their citizens, right? I mean, actually,
exactly.
An important paragraph, there's more than one, but you point out that this model, which has now been the subject of a very intense discussion for a couple of decades, because everybody predicted it wasn't going to work and there were all kinds of ideas about it. But you point out that millions of people have been lifted out of poverty and have educations and opportunities because of this model. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, China's lifted. Everywhere it's been tried. It was tried in Japan. It was tried in Germany. The Americans used it at a point when the British were dominant and were trying to promote free trade. And the Americans said, no, we're never going to develop as a nation economically if we accept your free trade proposals. Everywhere it's been tried, countries have become rich. I mean, that's the way in which you become rich. And the Chinese model, which is essentially the same as the Japanese and the German, the state-directed model, has proved worthy of lifting hundreds of millions out of poverty in China. And not surprisingly, since its aim is the internal development of the Chinese economy and not the aggrandizement of super-wealthy foreigners ensconced on Wall Street, which is the kind of model that Wall Street wants everyone to adopt, one that favors private enterprise and free trade within these U.S.-dominated blocks. And that's a model that's proved worthy of creating fabulous wealth on Wall Street, but has created abject poverty at the other extreme for people in the developing world.
Yeah, and of course, Wall Street is full of people who openly brag that when you ask them what they did with the money, they put it in their own pocket, or they put it offshore. And when you ask them about it, they say it's none of your business. I took it out of your pocket, but now it's in mine. Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Steve Gowans. You also point out that there's another Pacific power that goes so far has been unmentioned, but Russia is also Pacific. They weren't invited to join this.
No, both Russia and China. And I believe
is it the same sin? What's their sin? What needs to be corrected in their department?
Yeah, I guess the sin is being large enough to be able to challenge the United States economically and militarily. And yeah, I mean, there's been this effort that's been going on for quite some time to contain Russia. So, I mean, these are both these I don't even know if containment is really an apt word.
Well, by the way, I mean, this is a question of just, I start off with this idea of it's like West Side Story, you know, a sort of a gang approach. But I do recall that when we had this confrontation, and we're having it now in East Europe, and it started with Ukraine, with this where there was a seizure of power by people who terrified the president out of the country so that they could seize it. And at the time, the Russian leadership said, none of this is necessary. Why does the trade have to be two ways between the West and Ukraine? Why can't it be three ways? And so I'll put that question to Stephen Gowans. What is the answer to that?
Well, yeah, and then the agreement that Ukraine was going to sign with the West is an agreement that would reorient the Ukraine economy away from Russia toward the West and Europe and the United States, which is very significant because Ukraine is the largest trading partner of Russia. So any kind of agreement essentially says you no longer, I mean, you've changed your economy and the orientation entirely. Is going to be one that has, you know, profound, injurious economic implications for Russia. But you're right. I mean, this was an exclusionary agreement, which says we're going to exclude the Russians. We're going to contain them. We're going to undermine them.
Yeah, and speaking of containing, it contains a dangerous quality because it's basically, it's the old, there used to be a group of people called economic determinists and also people who said that war is inevitable under this kind of system, because you're really saying it's a kind of siege. I'll starve you to death if you don't do as you're told.
Well, and it's and what you're told is complete capitulation. We'll starve you to death unless you capitulate. But it was a highly aggressive act.
And can have people ought to understand there are Russian planes flying over Syria and American planes when we as a backdrop to this discussion. Stephen Gowans, thank you. The article is Pacific Partnership, an American aircraft carrier. Thank you very much. It's gowans.wordpress.com. Thanks again.
Thanks, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us at taylor@ciut.fm and web, taylor-report.com, and I'll remind you again, the 20th anniversary of A Different Book List is coming up, and it is October 24 at 6:30 p.m. at United Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, and everybody ought to want to go to that, food and entertainment, and it's a big celebration of a wonderful bookstore, 20th anniversary. For the Taylor Report, I'm Phil Taylor. Thank you, and thank you, Lucas. We'll see you next week.